Good morning. I'm going to open your Bibles to 2 Corinthians chapter 8. We'll be reading from there this morning. A lot of visitors, we're glad that you're here. Hope that you'll open your Bible too to study with us. We're going to talk a little bit this morning about the Sunday morning contribution, what we're going to participate in actually in a few moments. If we can get this to work. Okay. We do lessons on first principles a lot because we want to think about what first century Christians did. There's a lot of giving that's done in churches today, but sometimes that giving is not done the way they did it in the first century. Sometimes that giving is done and the money is used in ways that were not the way that Christians used it in the first century. People are not always that concerned about following God's pattern in the way that giving is done. So this morning I want us just to look and take a few minutes and look at some passages that talk to us about first century giving. And what I hope that the result of this will be is that we won't think about our giving as just some type of obligation or some type of duty, but it's something that is a response to the Lord and His goodness toward us, that it will come from our hearts and with purpose so that we accomplish what God intended it to accomplish. And we're going to use this text in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 to help us because Paul had written to the Corinthians about collection, and it kind of will help to guide us through what they did so that we can see what we're supposed to do. Now, just to tell you what was going on, there were saints in Jerusalem who were needy. They were involved. There was a famine in Jerusalem, pretty common in those parts, and they didn't have the resources to take care of themselves, couldn't provide for themselves food and shelter and clothing and those sort of things. So Paul appealed to other churches in other regions like Asia and Achaia and Macedonia and encouraged them to help these needy Christians in Jerusalem. So they pooled together money and sent that to Jerusalem to help those saints. And Corinthians had volunteered evidently to be a part of that. They wanted to help out a year before, but Paul found out that they had faltered. They kind of reneged on what they had promised to do. And so he sends Timothy and some others ahead with a letter, and in part he lets them know that he's sort of expecting them to finish what they had obligated themselves to do to help their needy brethren. And he's going to use, when we start reading here in chapter 8, he's going to use the Macedonians, who was groups of some churches up a little bit further north of Corinth, as a model to say to them, look at what the Macedonians are doing. I think you need to be a little bit more like they are. And he uses them as an example. So let's read 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9 and see if we can just pull out a few different lessons that will be helpful to us as principles for New Testament giving. Let's look in verse 1. Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God, which has been given in the churches of Macedonia. In that, in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much entreaty for the favor of the participation in the support of the saints. And this, not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. Okay. Several things here that I just want you to observe. Number one is the first thing that they did is that they gave credit to God. They gave God the credit, verse 1. We wish to make known to you the grace of God, which has been given in the churches of Macedonia. What he's about to compliment these churches for doing is really the result of what God had done in them, in their hearts. I think it's important that we see that Paul does not elevate the people's generosity above the one whose grace inspired it. God's the one who was working in them to produce this kind of generosity that they were giving, and he wants to give God the credit for that. We need to do that too. We need to, when people are generous, when they give what they have just to the Lord's service, we need to give God the credit because it's because of the influence, because of His grace and His mercy in their lives that inspired them to do the giving to help other people. So Paul just gives God the credit. The second thing that we can see is that these people, these brethren, gave in spite of their circumstances. Their situation was not good economically. He says that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. And this was hard times. Are we in hard times now? Most of us would say, we're kind of having a tough go. Economically, things weren't easy for them. And this made them an effective example for the Corinthians. You know, it's not always the case, but often the poor are more generous. I'm not saying dollar for dollar. I'm not speaking quantitatively. But in the how, many times the poor in the New Testament appeared more generous than the rich. You remember the example in Mark chapter 12 when Jesus talked about the poor widow when he was sitting at the in the temple with his disciples. This is Mark chapter 12, verse 41 through 44. It says, and he sat down opposite the treasury and began observing how the multitude were putting money into the treasury. And many rich people were putting in large sums. And a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which amount to a cent. And calling his disciples to him, he said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she owned. And she had all she had to live on. So this woman has no husband. She has no source of income. Nobody to provide for her her sustenance. And so she literally gave the last thing she had. And when Jesus looked at the rich putting in their large amounts of money, and he looks at this poor widow, he says, he valued her sacrifice above the amounts that other people were giving. Jesus placed value on giving, not in terms of quantity, but in terms of sacrifice. And this church kind of followed the same pattern, these Macedonians. They gave, it says, contrary to their ability. They may have neglected their basic necessities. There was a story, there was a congregation that I know of, where the evangelist was wanting to go and do some work overseas, and the group was not able to support him fully. They wanted to, but they weren't able to. And there was one family in that group that had 9 children. And this family was really poor. I mean, they didn't have much at all. And they made a decision to give up eating meat for the month and to save up all the money that they would have spent on buying meat for their family to give to help this person, this evangelist who was going to go on this trip. And I mean, while quantitatively that may have not amounted to a huge amount, it was very impressive. It was very inspirational to the group because they saw these people who didn't have much of anything, who gave up some things that most people would say, well, we just have to have that in order to provide for something that involved the Lord's service. That was encouraging, and that's what these people were doing here. They were giving up their basic necessities, going beyond their ability to help out in this. And so what a paradox. You know, in the midst of affliction, you have joy. And in the midst of deep poverty, you find generosity. And that's what God can do in people. Something else about them, too, is impressive. They are also self-motivated. It says in verse 4, it says, begging us with much entreaty for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. They were, I get the impression that they were so poor that Paul was not even going to ask them for help. You know, they insisted and Paul resisted. He knew that it would make their situation worse. Maybe, he may have tried to persuade them not to give, but they demanded to be allowed to participate in this, begging us with much urging. You know, you think about it, love doesn't have to be begged and pleaded with. Someone who truly loves, you don't have to twist their arm. But they insist on being able to use what they have to serve the Lord. We shouldn't need a lesson, and I don't like to do lessons on giving in order to prod people to increase their contribution. I want it to be a product of their love for the Lord. And these people were self-motivated. They saw a need, and they were determined to rise to the situation to help with that need. And what was it that inspired their generosity? Verse 5. And this, not as we'd expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. And God was first. And they saw themselves as belonging to the Lord. They were the property of the Lord. And so if you belong to the Lord, then it's not too hard to understand that your money belongs to the Lord too. And so that was the secret to their giving. And so they were saying, what can we do? What can we give to him? What do we have that might be useful here? So here are people who are, it's not misery, it's not people who are compelled or forced to give, but they denied themselves, they took up their cross willingly. And when God is first, I will imitate the Macedonians. And when I am first, I will not imitate the Macedonians. Well, there's some other things here that I thought was good too. That in verse 6 through 15, we sort of have, now that he's presented, put the Macedonians out in front of these people, now he wants to appeal to the Corinthians for what they needed to do. And so the first thing that I want you to notice is there is starting in verse, why don't we read that in verse 8? He says, I'm not speaking this as a command. In other words, I'm not demanding that you give this money, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. It was going to be the act of generosity that proved the sincerity of these Corinthians' love. They had promised to help. They said they loved the people. They really wanted to help. But now they're backing out. And Paul's saying, you say you want to help? You say that you love these people? Then prove it. That's basically what he's saying. Somebody says, oil brother so-and-so, he's really suffering. I really feel for him. He's really having a hard time out there. Sister so-and-so, she's really out on a limb right now. She really can't make... Well, I sure hope somebody does something for her. I really love her. And that is what he's talking about here. That the Corinthians were doing, they say that they love, but they weren't doing anything to show it. James chapter 2, you guys just studied that in your Sunday morning class, or Wednesday night class. James said, what use is it, my brethren? Verse 14, if a man says he has faith, but he has no works, can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith that has no works is dead, being by itself. Paul said, or James says to us, you say you have faith, you say you believe in the Lord, but you won't help the person who's in need. He says, your faith is worthless. It's really of no use. And so here's people who really demonstrated that love is proved by what it caused them to do, the Macedonians. Not by what they said, not by how they felt, but by what they did. And he called the Corinthians to do the same thing. Well, Jesus was their model. He's the greatest model, I guess, for any of us. If you look in verse 9, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, that through his poverty you might become rich. How poor did Jesus become? Well, he had no place to lay his head. When he came, he was crucified. It's that sacrifice that motivates us. It's the fact that his bank account was completely empty. He gave up everything he had in order to save us. And that motivates us. And that, it just teaches us we need to put ourselves out more. We need to empty ourselves to meet the needs of others. And anytime we're tempted to say, well, I do enough. I do more than brother so-and-so. I do a lot. Then we probably need to look at Jesus again and see that he outgives us all because he had so much more to give. He was the richest and he became the poorest so that we could become rich. How much less can we do for others? One other thing that we can learn in this section is that God can do a lot with a little. Look in verse 11 and 12. Verse 11 and 12. But now he says, we'll start in verse 10. I give my opinion in this matter, for this is to your advantage, who were the first to begin a year ago, not only to do this, but to desire to do it, but now finish doing it also, that just as there was the readiness to desire it, so there may be also the completion of it by your ability. For if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what he doesn't have. Paul says, a year ago you were very excited about this. You were ready. You were making this commitment. We're going to help out. But he said, now you need to finish what you started. You need to do what you promised to do. And he says, it's not about how much that you give. It's about your willingness to do what you can. God doesn't ask us to do more than what we're able. But we ought to do what we set out to do. We need to fulfill our promises. And God can do a lot with a little. He says, it's not how much. Verse 12, for the readiness is present is acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what he does not have. Let me tell you that one of the fallacies of a sponsoring church arrangement is the failure to understand this principle. Let me give you an example of that. Here's Tingsboro, and they say, there's this tremendous need with some brethren in the South. And we sure like to help out with that, but we just don't have much. We don't have much to offer because we're a small group and our expenditures are pretty high and we just can't do much. We only have maybe $200 or $300, and that's not going to go very, very far. But if the church in Providence there, if they're going to make a bigger effort, we'll send our money to Providence, and then if Wallingford Church, they send their money to Providence, then we may have a big amount, maybe a few thousand, and that'll make a difference. And then we'll send that down there to the South, and that'll make a difference. See, we say we don't have much. God can't do much with what we have. But if we pool it with everybody else's, that'll make a difference. Well, that's failing to understand this principle. Because God is saying here, it doesn't matter how much you have. Just do what you can, and He'll take care of the rest. You know, think about the loaves and the fishes. We teach that lessons are to the children in the classes. Do we understand the principle for us? That Jesus was given only 5 loaves and a couple of fish, and he had 5,000 people, and he took that small amount and he multiplied it many times to accomplish what was needed to feed those people, and he had an abundance left over. That he's able to take a little and do a lot with that. And so the lesson is, that we need to believe in him. And we say, we can say, I believe in Jesus. But we don't believe that he can still multiply the loaves and the fish. We don't believe that he can take what little we have to offer and do great things with it. And that's part of what it means to believe. And I like the widow with the copper coins. She had 2, as opposed to all those people with all the money. What did God do with her 2 coins? Did he multiply those? Well, I don't know, but she has become the example for all centuries after that to motivate us. He used her and what little she gave to become a great example for millions of people of what it means to do what you can with what you have, and God will bless you in that. Well, there are some things that inhibit our giving. I'll mention a couple of those. Number one is that sometimes when people don't have a purpose for giving, then it inhibits their giving. For example, back in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1, 2, and 3, is when Paul communicated with the Corinthians, at least the first time, as far as we know, about this collection that he would like to take up for these needy saints. And he wrote them, and he says, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, let each one of you put aside and save as he may prosper, so that there are no collections to be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomever you may approve, I shall send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. And if it's fitting for me to go also, then they will go with me. I think it's important here that the Corinthians were not told to give just for the sake of giving. Paul didn't write them a letter and say, listen, I think everybody needs to give every first day of the week, so here's my command, everybody start giving. There was a particular purpose in mind. Those Corinthians knew exactly what was going to be done with what they gained. And that made a difference in their giving. It wasn't a duty, it wasn't an obligation. There were specific things that he wanted to do. And you know, that makes a big difference in people's giving. We needed to tell people what we plan to do with what they give. You know, people need to see the correlation between the giving and the need. I mean, that happens all the time in society. We understand that. You know, some type of need comes up in our society, some type of situation, and there are organizations and people that will rally and say, look, there's this terrible situation. There's desperate, you know, and it's worthy of help. We need to help them. And people will just will rise to the occasion because they like to help. But if you don't give them a reason, don't give them what's going on, what the particular need is, people aren't going to get it. And it's the same thing in churches. We need to make people aware of what we're going to do and what the need is so they can correlate their see the correlation between their giving and the need. So that's one thing. When people have no purpose for their giving, then it will be less than what it could be. A second thing is that that inhibits giving is not trusting in God. Look back to chapter 8 of 2 Corinthians again. Let's go back there. 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And we'll read verse 13 through 15. This is, Paul is sort of speaking about what was going on in the minds of the Corinthians. He says, "For this is not for the ease of others and for your affliction, but by way of equality. At this present time, your abundance being a supply for their want, and that their abundance also may become a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not lack. This is, what's the most common objection sometimes to generosity? It's this. You know, we're going to be poor. We're going to be in poverty. Things will be really hard for us. I mean, the Corinthians are thinking about these saints in Jerusalem, and they're saying, well, they're going to be prosperous, and they're going to have all this money, and they're going to be doing great, and then we're going to be in affliction. We're going to be suffering. How does that translate? Well, we say, well, what if something happens and we need that money? What about us? Well, the economy's bad. And there might be some kind of crisis, or maybe a tornado, maybe a flood, and we'd like to give, but we just can't do it. Churches do that, unfortunately. They don't do what they ought to do with what they collect. Well, we just never know when something might happen. You know, furnace might go out, might need to replace a roof, and those windows are getting kind of old. We might need to replace those windows, and so you know, we lose members. Kind of a transient church. We just better not give and help out here. And what's Paul's answer to that? He says, God will supply. God will take care of that. He uses an illustration in verse 15 from the Old Testament when God provided Israel with the manna in the wilderness. You remember that they had been out in the wilderness for a period of time and they were complaining. They needed food. They said, we need food to eat. And God says, I'll take care of you. You know, you go out in the morning and you'll find what you need for food and you collect just what you need, and tomorrow I'll provide more. Don't collect more than what you need. Get what you need and I'll give you the more tomorrow. And so that's what they do. They go out and get the manna in the morning, get what they needed. The next day they go out and they find manna on the ground again. What God did not tell them was, everybody hoard up as much as you can for a rainy day. Rather, you know, the idea here is when we are blessed with an abundance, we give it. So that when we are in need, the ones that God is blessing with abundance will help us. That's the idea. And that's God's plan for taking care of the needy. Not that we stuff as much money in our pockets, because you just never know what might happen. And that involves learning to trust in God. And it's one reason people are not generous in their giving in churches, because they don't trust in God's provision for the future. And we don't follow His pattern. We got to look out for ourselves. And that's really, you know, we say we believe in God, but this is really a test of whether we really believe in God or not. Here's another thing that inhibits our giving, and that is greed. Look a little bit further down. Chapter 9, drop down to chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. Paul says, "It is superfluous for me to write to you about this ministry to the saints, because I know your readiness." He's talking to the Corinthians. "I know your readiness, of which I boast about you to the Macedonians. Namely, that Achaia," that's the region where Corinth was, "Achaia has been prepared since last year, and your zeal has stirred up most of them." So he's saying, you know, "I don't really need to write to you, Corinthians, about this, because, you know, you asked me to be a part of this thing a year ago. And I've already told the Macedonians about you, how anxious you are to participate, and you inspired them by your anxiousness to help out in this. But," verse 3 says, "I have sent the brethren that our boasting about you may not be made empty in this case, that as I was saying, you may be prepared, lest if any Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to speak of you, should be put to shame by this confidence. So I thought it necessary to urge the brethren that they would go on ahead of you and arrange beforehand your previously promised bountiful gift, that the same might be ready as a bountiful gift and not affected by covetousness." What is it that diminishes the generosity of our gift? Sometimes it's greed. Sometimes it's covetousness. We want it for ourselves. I mean, theoretically, you'd like to give a lot to the service of the Lord, but, well, I'd sure like to have this, too. You know, we've got all those bills that we need to pay, and, you know, we wanted to do some things this year, and our budget's just not going to allow for that, so, you know, we had to set up a payment plan to be able to do that. You know, we want to go on that cruise, but we can't afford it, so we're going to put on a payment plan. And see, there's our money, and it's going toward all these things. And it's all about us. And it's greed that diminishes the size of the gift. Paul didn't want that to happen here. And he was afraid that it was happening. So he wrote them to say, "Don't disappoint me. Don't make me embarrassed when I come down there and the Macedonians are with me and you don't have what you promised because of your covetousness." So there's something that will inhibit sometimes the giving in a congregation or the giving of individual, the idea of greed. Now, the last thing that I want us to read as we kind of come to a close of this is a wonderful lesson that Paul tries to teach them on sowing and reaping. Look down to verse 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 6. And he uses a farming example. So let's read this example he uses for them. Now this I say, he who sows sparingly shall also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully shall also reap bountifully. Let each one do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. As it is written, he scattered abroad, he gave to the poor, and his righteousness abides forever. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. Well, he uses a farming illustration, which is not too surprising. That was common. Jesus used farming a lot of times. And what you have to do is you kind of have to imagine him that you're on a farm where you actually are using the seed that you get from this year's crops to replant for next year. And that's what they did in that day. And you have some options to what you do with that seed that you get from your crops. You could eat it, or you could plant it for next year, or you could do some of both. And the question is, what leads to a bigger crop? What will lead to a bigger crop next year? Well, if you plant more than you eat, you don't eat as much, But you get a bigger harvest, and you actually even start multiplying the harvest. Now, if you get greedy and you eat up most of what you get in your harvest, then you're going to have the harvest get smaller for the next year, and because you have less seed to plant. The more we plant, the more you receive. That's what he's saying. And now there's a point that we shy away from sometime in this. Verse 6, he says, "Now this I say, he who sows sparingly shall also reap sparingly. And he who sows bountifully shall also reap bountifully." I mean, the general principle is, the more you plant, the more you get. Now, TV preachers and a lot of times abuse this text and misuse it to incite greed and materialism. They say, you know, you sow it and God will grow it. Or the more you give, the bigger houses and the nicer cars and the better vacations and the nicer job you'll have. That's not what he's saying here. Look again at this. Look at verse 8. It says, "God is able to make all grace abound to you, that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed." And then drop down to verse 10. "He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness." And then look at verse 12. He says, "For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God." So you've got, you know, the point is, the more you invest in the service of the Lord, the more you will have to invest. He will give you more for every good deed, to do more good deeds, to do more sowing, for all liberality. The more you give, the more you will have to give. Not the more you'll have to get rich on. Not the more I give, the more I'll have for me. Rather, the more I'll have for the Lord or to help my brethren. That principle makes sense. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28, whenever he was teaching these Ephesians about not stealing but working, he says, Ephesians 4:28, "Let him who steal no longer, but rather let him labor, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something more for himself." Right? No. He says, "In order that he may have something to share with him who is in need." I want to ask you a question. It's the last time you got a raise. Think about the last time you got a raise. The last time you went up in the income bracket. What's the first thing that came to your mind? What did you think? What you could do with what you received? Did you think, well, there's more that I have that I can use for the Lord's service. There's more that I can have to do the Lord's work. Or did you think, now I can get this. Now I can pay off this bill. Now I can go on this vacation that I never went on before. You know, Paul saw in these Macedonians the spirit that he wanted to see in the Corinthians. Now we have more to use for the service of the Lord. I'll tell you, that's a challenge for me. And we're not conditioned that way in our society. We're conditioned to move up in our station in life and use that to better our own self and material things and in our recreation and our secular joys of life. But we are not conditioned to think of the more that we get is to be used to serve others who really are in need. Well, let's look at one final thing, the blessings of giving. There are some blessings that Paul saw when he looked at the possibility of these brethren contributing what they had and finishing what they promised. Notice how he thinks, as opposed to sometimes how we think. He speaks about their giving and their being enriched by their giving. And he says, "You will be enriched," verse 11. This is chapter 9 and verse 11. I'm sorry, I started put 13 on the slide, but let's start in verse 11. He says, "You'll be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God." Look at verse 12. The ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but also is overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. You see what's happening? Paul sees their liberality, their generous giving, their participation in this work as an opportunity to bring grace, thanksgiving and praise to the Lord. And look a little bit further. Look in verse 14. He says, start in verse 13. Because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God. That is, the Jews will glorify your God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all. So again, here are the Jews, and they're going to glorify God as they see these Gentiles, these Corinthians, fulfilling their ministry and proving their love. While they also, verse 14, by prayer on your behalf, yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. Now what does that do? Now the sacrifice of these Gentiles to help these Jewish brethren is going to create a sense of unity among them. It's going to cause the Jews to love these Gentiles more. You know, there's a lot of friction between these two races. A lot of dislike, disharmony. But now you have the Gentiles who are sacrificing themselves and giving up things that were theirs in order to bless the Jews in their moments of need. And Paul sees this sacrificial love as a way to bring the two together and to unite them. And then finally, he closes with his final thought. Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift. God gave so much more than us because He gave His own Son. And we can never pay the Lord back. That's impossible to do. There's no gift that we could ever give, no amount that we could ever give to balance the scales, much less to tip the scales in our favor. What does God want from us? He wants our lives. He wants us to give ourselves to Him. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, he said, I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. What does God want for us? He wants our entire life. He wants us not to behave like the world, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind. In other words, He wants our hearts. Maybe this morning you need to give your heart to the Lord. Don't do sermons on giving just to raise a contribution. Do a sermon on giving to help us see the principles that guided the hearts of New Testament Christians. For us to see these were people, especially the Macedonians, whose hearts were truly given to the Lord. He had won their hearts, and they wanted to give themselves back to Him. The Corinthians is an example of what can happen if we allow the world to take control of our hearts again. Greed and self-centeredness. And Paul is pleading with them to look at the cross, look at the indescribable gift that God had given to them, and to win their hearts back, to be more like the Lord that they had promised to serve. That's what we need to do. We need to look at the indescribable gift of God's love, the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, and give Him our hearts as a generous offering of gratitude for what He's done for us. Maybe you'll do that this morning and become a Christian by believing in Him and repenting and being baptized and forgiveness of your sins. Or maybe you'll just become more generous in your heart and serving your brethren and loving them. But whatever the case would be, we invite you to start that as we stand and sing our songs.